everybody, and welcome to the first evening in a weekend workshop on the 7-point thought transformation. If you didn't pick one up on the table when you came in, then you can grab one now. We're very lucky to have with us Jonathan Landau. He has been a practicing Buddhist since 1970 when he first met Lama Yeshe, the founder of our mother organization. If you have heard Jonathan earlier this week, then you know how knowledgeable he is, and he's really quite amazing. He speaks in full paragraphs. So he'll be here all this weekend teaching on this. He'll also on Sunday morning lead our normal Sunday morning session. He's also going to be here Monday night teaching the first night of the Discovering Buddhism module on how to meditate. He'll be here on Wednesday teaching on the Lam Rim. On Thursday, he'll give a presentation about making pilgrimage to Buddhist holy sites, which he has been to many of them multiple times, so that should be very interesting. And then on Saturday of next week, he'll be doing a presentation on the life of Shakyamuni Buddha. We're really lucky to have somebody this knowledgeable. He's an FPMT teacher. He's been teaching at Land of Medicine Buddha for many years. As some of you may be familiar, we're only at Kadampa Center. We offer everything Dharma-related at no charge because we think these teachings are just too precious for it to be an obstacle, for money to be an obstacle for anyone. If you were to go to a paid weekend workshop like this, it would probably cost several hundred dollars. We do have some expenses involved in bringing him here, so if you're moved by what you hear, we would very much appreciate any donations. You can make them in the box outside the door or in the bookstore, and there's also a place online that you can do that. And without further ado, we'll bring him in.
Mentioned in previous visits, offering prostrations in the beginning is your custom and you like to do it, then please feel free. If not, if it's something you're not comfortable with, then it's not mandatory at all.
Om Namo Manjun Shriya Namo Su Shriya Namo Untama Shriya So. Om Namo Manjushriya Namo Sushriya Namo Untama Shriya Soha. Om Namo Manjushriya Namo Namo Untama Shriya Soha. Thank you.
Donna, there seems to be a lot of feedback. Is it clear, or is there feedback?
There's a little feedback.
Yeah, there was a little bit. Chris is
making adjustments.
Oh.
Adjustments as we speak.
So, as most or all of you already know, it is a custom when there is a talk or class dealing with Buddha Dharma to remember to include three parts to the organization of that talk. And the first part is setting the motivation. The second part is the main body of the talk, and then the third part is the dedication at the end. And it's considered, or it's not considered complete unless those three parts are present. And as those of you who have had the fortune to receive teachings from Kepche Sopa Rinpoche in the past know, that first part, the setting of the motivation, when he teaches, could occupy the whole hour. Have you had that experience with him?
Yeah. And what?
Yeah, that's true. Right.
That, 2 hours.
That's right. And then the dedication occupies whatever time is left in that particular time zone. You know. And it's not just a whim of Rinpoche to do that, to have such an extensive motivation, which is very, very common, very often with his teachings. But it's a recognition of the fact that of the three parts of the presentation, as is true for the three parts of any activity that you engage in, it is the setting of the motivation in the beginning that is most responsible for whatever benefit we derive from that activity, you know. So if the the motivation in the beginning is really quite clear and solid, and if we're able to kind of ingest it and get into that state of mind, then even if the teaching is being given by, you know, some charlatan from New Jersey, you'll still get benefit because of the motivation with which you're attending those teachings. Okay, and this importance of the motivation covers the whole range of activities of the example that I like to use is of someone who's a philanthropist and gives millions of dollars to found, let's say, a hospital, right? So I think everyone would agree that that's quite a virtuous, positive action because it'll end up bringing benefit to many, many people, right? But not everyone who is in the position of being the philanthropist has a very good motivation, right? For some of the people, it happens that the only important part of the hospital is the plaque that has his name on it. He doesn't really care about the rest, right? As long as people see my name on my hospital, right? That's all that's really important. That's true for some people. Not all people, by any means. But some people are so motivated for promoting their own ego identity, as it were, that everything that they do is self-referential in that way. So in this case, you might have someone who gave a huge amount of money to found a hospital that's actually going to have benefit for a lot of people, but the amount of benefit that he gets from making that donation is quite small, because his motivation is completely self-serving. Whereas there might be another situation where someone just gives a few dollars but truly wishes that this be beneficial for all beings and that they'll be healthy and et cetera, et cetera, and then would gain a huge amount of positive merit from that. Okay? So the same thing is true in a situation in which we're gathered together to think about and discuss and question some elements of the Dharma Buddhist path. It's the motivation with which we're listening to it, that's from your side, and the motivation with which it's presented, that's from my side. It's the motivation which is most important. And so it's worthwhile to spend a little time, maybe not the several hours that Lama Zopa would spend, but at least a little time trying to get into that proper frame of mind. I know for myself that this is quite important because, you know, sitting in front of a group of people is, in a sense, like being an entertainer, right? It is. So that if I tell a joke, I expect people to laugh. And if they don't, I'm really upset. Why? Because my main interest is not benefiting you, it's getting applause for what I'm doing, right? And that's a very, very easy trap for a teacher to fall into. Okay? So it's quite important for me, I know, from my own experience, to make sure that at the beginning I try to push any such self-centered motivation. You know, what are they going to think of me? I hope they like me, right? I hope they laugh at the right places, not at the wrong places, right? You know, I hope they say they like the talk when it's over. All those thoughts which naturally come up in my mind have to be put to the side. And I need to remind myself, well, the only reason for being part of this experience is that the Dharma is meant to benefit people, and it's that motivation which should be foremost in the mind, not this I, me, mine mentality, which arises so easily. Okay? And then from the side of the people who are listening or participating, you know, from the listening point of view, also motivation is extremely important, because you know, sometimes people come to a gathering like this. I don't know whether you're going to believe me or not, but sometimes it happens that a couple come together, and only one member of the couple wanted to come. The other one is coming only to please the spouse or the friend, right? So there's no motivation to try to derive something from the teaching other than some kind of domestic harmony, you know, right? That's possible. Do you think so? It is possible, right? Or a person may approach a Dharma teaching as if it were a list of facts. You know, they find out what the subject matter is meant to be, and they think, oh, I haven't studied that before, or I have, but I've never gotten a complete teaching it before. So here, maybe if I attend this, it'll fill in the places that I missed before, you know. And not so much that those facts are going to be useful for one's spiritual development, it's just that we're relating to it like we relate to a class that we took in high school or in college. You know, we want to be able to answer the questions on the test at the end. Right? So any motivation like that is not what we would consider a pure motivation, because the pure motivation has to be, at the very, very least, finding a way to decrease the strength of our mental afflictions. You know, hatred, jealousy, desires, attachment, arrogance, and the like. To decrease them, knowing that if they're not decreased, if they stay or if they grow stronger, it's just going to lead to more and more suffering. And not wanting to experience that suffering result, we think, well, at a Dharma teaching, maybe I'll pick up some ways of lessening the strength of my delusions, of my afflictions, of my hatred, greed, ignorance, and the like. Okay, so that would be considered a quite an excellent motivation, because that's using the Dharma for what it's meant to be used for. Some people, explain that the word Dharma, the Sanskrit word Dharma, can be understood as having the meaning of holding back, to hold one back from suffering. So a Dharma teaching is meant to keep us from falling into the precipice of further and further dissatisfaction and suffering. So if our motivation is wanting to have less suffering in the future by diminishing the strength of our delusions, then that's completely in accord with the purpose of Dharma. So that's considered an excellent motivation. But it's not the most excellent motivation. Because even if we do diminish the strength of the delusions and refrain from creating the kind of negative karma that brings suffering in its wake, right? If we haven't actually eliminated those delusions from their root, we haven't completely cleansed them from our mind, then sooner or later they're going to reappear. It's like the analogy of a person who discovers that the tree in the backyard of the house that you just moved to is a poisonous tree. So the fruit on it is going to be dangerous. So the person makes sure that all the fruit is taken off and then prunes back the branches. Right? Well, that's good. That's helpful. But it's not a final solution, is it? Because as long as the tree is alive, it's going to continue to produce, well, those branches will regenerate themselves, and eventually more fruit, more poisonous fruit, will be produced. Okay? So if you want to really be safe, and especially if you want to make your family safe, then it's not enough to prune back those branches, but you have to make sure that the tree is incapable of producing any more poison. And the only way you can do that is to cut it down or uproot it completely. So in a similar fashion, it's necessary not to just weaken, but eventually uproot completely the various delusions on the mind from their deepest point, from the ignorance that mistakes the nature of reality. Mm-hmm. And then, if we're able to do that, that's a very high accomplishment. We attain a state of an arhat, a foe destroyer, nirvana, the cessation of all suffering. So that's also an excellent motivation to use the teachings as a way of getting out of samsara. That term samsara, is that familiar to everyone here, or is it a new term for anybody? Because it is Sanskrit, it doesn't always come up in ordinary conversation. So samsara, it's a Sanskrit word, and literally it means wandering. And the Tibetan for it means circling. And it describes a situation in which we move from one unsatisfactory state to another, one unsatisfactory type of existence to another, looking for happiness and well-being, finding momentary pleasure, but experiencing repeated frustration and disappointment. And so as long as our mind is governed by those various delusions that I mentioned, those afflictions such as hatred and jealousy and arrogance and ignorance and the like, as long as our mind is under the influence of those afflictions and under the influence of the karma, the actions motivated by those afflictions, then we are caught on that wheel. We're wandering through samsara, through cyclic existence, you know, moving uncontrollably from one state of, we could say, disappointment to another. Now, maybe that's a little bit too abstract, right? But think of experiences we've had in our own life on a day-to-day basis. We engage in some activity, and in the beginning it might be quite pleasant, but after a while it gets cloying, and eventually we get bored with it, and eventually it becomes distasteful, and then we look for something else. So we leave that, right? And we engage into another activity, hoping to derive some measure of satisfaction from it. And again, in the beginning, it seems nice, it seems pleasant enough, but after a while, it too fails to bring us the long-lasting satisfaction and happiness we looked for. For me, one of the best recent examples I've seen, explanation of this syndrome that I've seen, was in a Sunday comics of Calvin and Hobbes. And if you're not familiar with Calvin and Hobbes, he's a rather naughty young boy who has a tiger that for him is alive. For everyone else, it's a stuffed animal. But for him, it's his companion. It's his closest friend. Right? So the tiger's name is Hobbes. And so they do everything together. And in this particular Sunday cartoon, it was starts out in wintertime, and the two of them were playing outside in the snow, and they're really enjoying throwing snowballs at each other. But then they start shivering and start turning blue, so they decide to run inside and stand in front of the fire. And they're standing in front of the fire, and they go, ah, like that. But as they stand there, they start to get hotter and hotter and harder, until before they were blue with the cold, now they're red with the heat. And so they rush outside, and they're in the snow again, and when they start cooling off, they go, ah, like that. But as they're out in the cold a little while longer, now they start shivering again, start getting cold, turning blue again, and they run inside. Now they're standing in front of the fire another time, and Calvin turns to Hobbes and says, if this isn't true happiness, nothing is. And this is a theme that Kepche Sopa Rinpoche very, very often talks about, that what appears to us to be true happiness or pleasure is, we only think of it because the uncomfortable situation that we left is diminishing, and the new situation hasn't yet become uncomfortable. Right? So this is a samsaric syndrome. This is a syndrome of cyclic existence, that we're looking for satisfaction, happiness, peace of mind, whatever it is, and at most we get momentary pleasure, but eventually it is not soul satisfying. It just becomes another thing to be frustrated with. Okay, so when the various delusions are free from the mind, then, you know, and we achieve this state or approach this state of nirvana, the complete absence of suffering, then there's a bliss of the mind which doesn't decrease. It's not based on or is not dependent upon outward circumstances. It's the quality of our mind, the quality of our experiences themselves. So, if we're motivated to come to a teaching like this, you know, actually I think you'd have to be a little bit misguided in this case, but thinking, well, maybe if I attend this talk, I'll figure out how to achieve nirvana. Right? That would be a rather high expectation. But that would at least be a good motivation, wouldn't it? You know, trying to find a way out of this samsaric syndrome of running after happiness only to experience frustration. That would be a very good use of the Dharma teachings. That would be an excellent motivation. Right? But again, not the most excellent motivation. So the first motivation was to overcome one's own suffering. The second was to have a lasting experience, not just a temporary, but a lasting experience of bliss and well-being. Right? But neither of those, as excellent as they are sufficient. Why not? Sounds pretty nice to me. Why wouldn't either of those be sufficient? Right, exactly. I heard what two of the people said, and they were basically the same thing. There's everybody else to consider, and you need to help others. Right. Because up to this point, the vast, virtually all of the focus has been on, as George Harrison sang, I, me, mine. But instead of I, me, mine sensual enjoyments, it's I, me, mine nirvana. Right? My liberation. One being. Yes, please.
I have to be obedient to the mic.
I understand that, but one of the things I think that, for me, that gets lost in that is you don't get to nirvana without practicing a great deal of compassion for others.
Oh, that's true. That's definitely
true. You know, I mean, it's not a completely selfish road.
No.
No, I mean, but I think when you say, oh, I'm just trying to get out of it for myself, that notion that in order to get to nirvana, you're practicing an awful lot of good qualities that have tremendous benefit for other sentient beings. I know that's editorializing, but I hate that. But I hate. I mean, it feels to me it almost gets lost sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate you bringing it out so clearly. You know, even the path to one's own liberation from suffering requires quite a lot of virtuous actions, and many of those virtuous actions have the motive of benefiting others. Right? So it is not a completely selfish attitude. But the difference, I believe, is that up to this point, the main emphasis is I want to get out of my suffering. And I will practice compassion because that's a way that helps me gain the merit and do the cleansing that's required to reach that state. But the emphasis is primarily on one's own attainment. And the compassion that we do for others is, in a sense, one of the means in that direction. So it is compassion, you know. It's not completely selfish. But the focus is still on oneself, primarily. Whereas when we move to the third level of motivation, it's with a recognition that we're all in it together. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama always says, it's like we're all members of one family. And so one becomes motivated not merely by compassion, but what is sometimes called great compassion or universal compassion, in which the whole purpose for following the spiritual path is to be able to help others, not for me to achieve my own cessation of suffering, but for me to reach a state in which I can be of most benefit, most lasting benefit for others. Okay? So on this level of... would you say that's a fair assessment, Venerable?
Yeah, obviously that's the motivation for enlightenment, and nirvana is kind of a nice way station on the way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mean that.
Okay. And that nirvana is a nice way station on the way, and some beings, I understand, might rest there for a while before kind of getting pulled on.
That's a very interesting point, because from the point of view of this third level of motivation, the Mahayana or the Bodhisattva path, this lower nirvana, this self-liberation, is actually a trap. Even though, you know, the cessation of suffering sounds like a wonderful thing and is a wonderful thing, it is actually some kind of trap, as opposed to just a way station. Because the bliss of that state is so extraordinary that the Buddhas would have to shout really loud in our ear to remind us that there's more work we have to do. Right? In fact, in some teachings, they use a phrase which, when you first come across it, would strike almost any student as very strange. They say, save me from the fears of samsara and nirvana. The fears of samsara and nirvana. Oh, the fears of samsara, I understand that, right? All the realms of suffering, all the headaches, all the problems, everything that worldly beings on all the different realms experience, those are the fears of samsara. You know, all the pains and everything, frustrations. But the fears of nirvana, well, nirvana is beyond suffering. There's no fear in nirvana, right? But there in the text that says it, save me from the fears of samsara and nirvana. And why is nirvana said to have a fear in it? Not because there's anything fearful in the state itself for the person, but being in that state prevents us from benefiting, you know, using all our energies for the benefit of others. So we're kind of blissing out like that. Yes, please.
Well, it seems to me that unless you're willing...
Oh, wait for the mic.
Unless you're willing to give up on the complacency of nirvana, you really can't eradicate self-clinging, because... you know, obviously, I think that's kind of obviously that it's still there. It's the last vestige of self-clinging mm-hmm. that you're giving up when you take the Bodhisattva route.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not going to stay in nirvana, because you have to give that away too. Otherwise, you haven't really given it all away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's one way of putting it. That the motivation at some significant point has to shift, preferably before the, you've already fallen into the hole of nirvana, as blissful it is. Well, you're still at the earlier stages of the path. You start cultivating this recognition that we are all in it together, that everybody wants to be happy, nobody wants to suffer, and my happiness is totally dependent on the interaction with all the rest of the beings on this planet. And I'm only one. The others, just counting the humans here, is 7 billion, but the number is much, much higher than that when you count all the other life forms and all the other places where consciousness exists in the universe. But just take 7 billion, that's a big enough number for us, you know? So on one side, there's me wanting my happiness, and there's 7 billion other people, the vast majority of whom are lost. They really are wandering. They really are going around in circles. And we know that because we're one of those people too. We recognize it. It's not like we're putting ourselves ahead or outside of those people. We recognize that syndrome because we've experienced it and are still experiencing it to some extent ourselves. Right? But if we're going to find a way out of suffering, it has to be a way out of suffering that benefits everyone, not just 1/7 billionth of the planet. Right? Does that make sense? So this attitude in which we take our own egocentricity, our own self-centered concern on I, me, me, mine, we take that and we put it, let's say, on the back burner, way on the back burner, and instead turn our attention to the welfare of others, then becomes the motivation, even as we're on the earlier stages of the path, even when we're engaging in those practices that you'd engage in when you just simply want to lessen your suffering and get rid of the, lessen the strength of the delusions, even when you're on this part of the path you want to uproot the delusions, even on those earlier stages, you incorporate this bodhicitta motivation, the motivation to win full enlightenment, not just the nirvana of one's own individual peace, but that state of Buddhahood in which you have the compassion and the wisdom and this extraordinary skillful means of being able to help others. Right? And you cultivate that, loving kindness, compassion. Yeah, I'm reminded that every time I say compassion, I have to hyphenate it with love, so we don't leave out love. Okay, but it's implied there, whether it's said or not. You know, so this wish to be of maximum benefit to others, we try to incorporate that at the earliest possible state of our practice, and then especially as we progress through the Dharma training, put great emphasis on cultivating this bodhicitta, make it as real as possible. So I got on to this topic because I was saying that the most important thing, most important aspect of any action is the motivation with which we do the action. It's even more important than the action itself. In terms of what are we going to derive from that action, right? And if what we're looking for is the attainment, or let's put it another way, the fulfillment of our own highest potential, if that's what we want, you know, to fulfill our highest and deepest potential, that's nothing less than the state of a Buddha's enlightenment. You know, this a state that has all of those qualities with which we can effortlessly and spontaneously help others. And we can use the example of the teachers that we've met, the teachers we've met that have inspired us. I don't mean a lecturer who flew in from California but was born in New Jersey. I mean a real teacher, you know, someone who embodies the teachings, right? Someone like Kepche Zopa Rinpoche or His Holiness the Dalai Lama or quite a number of other teachers that we can think of who dedicate, quite obviously dedicate their entire life to nothing other than helping others out of love, out of compassion, out of a true concern, out of a real fellow feeling for them. So that, you know, most of you know that a few years back, Kepche Sopa Rinpoche, to all appearances, experienced a very severely debilitating stroke. Right? Very serious. And I saw videos that were made in the hospital right in the early stages when he was manifesting this experience. There wasn't one element of self-pity. Instead, he was laughing. And I had friends back in California who work with stroke victims. And they said to me, you know, while we work with stroke victims, the biggest danger to them is not so much the physical experience that they're having, but the despair into which they sink when they can't speak very well anymore, they can't move their limbs very well anymore, it's hard for them to think clearly anymore, then many of them fall into this state of despair. And despair is nothing other than the deepest pit of this I, me, mine mentality. Right? And they said, I wish I could show all my stroke victims, all my patients, this video of Lama Zopa. Because here he's having all of these same experiences, you know, the loss of the ability to speak clearly and control the movement of the limbs and those kinds of things. And yet, he's not suffering from it, you know. Instead, he's asking how other people are, you know. He's demonstrating to others that the mind is more powerful. And so we can get a sense that it is possible to cultivate a state of mind which is so deeply absorbed into the welfare of others that even when some negative experience arises, it is not experienced as the kind of suffering it would be if our mind is still in that I, me, mine mentality. Does that make sense? So it's very encouraging to know about these teachings on cultivating this precious bodhicitta motivation, this wish to attain enlightenment for the sake of benefiting others. And within the Tibetan tradition, these teachings are traced back, well, as I pointed out the other day, all the teachings themselves go back to the time of Buddha, but this formulation of the teachings into what's known as the technique of Mahayana thought transformation or mind training, or if you like the Tibetan Lojong, that kind of teaching, which talks about how to cultivate this precious bodhicitta and strengthen it. That was brought to Tibet by a great Indian master named Atisha just a little over 1,000 years ago. And that tradition that he brought in permeated all the lineages of Tibetan Buddhism that grew up, not only the Gelugpa tradition, which is the main tradition practiced here at Kanapa Center, but the Kagyu tradition, the Sakya tradition, the Nyingma tradition. All of these were influenced very, very deeply, and all of them give teachings on this Lojong, on this thought transformation, mind training. And that is meant to be the subject matter of this weekend, in whatever time is left. Right? So, since that is the main subject matter, though of course we'll only be able to reach a fraction of it, even if we had weeks and weeks to talk about it, but we'll do as much as we can during today and the following weekend. Now that we are together participating in this activity, then I have to be sure from my side that my motivation squares with the bodhicitta. You know, that it's not contrary to it, that it's not filled with self-cherishing, egocentricity. Right? I can't say it has to be the bodhicitta motivation itself, because that's still in the future, way in the future. Right, that's a great accomplishment to actually transform the mind so that the bodhicitta is the primary state of consciousness, and that is something I haven't developed yet. But I have a great admiration for the bodhicitta. You know, seeing it in the activities of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Geshe Ngawen Darge, Lama Thubten Yeshe, to see, and so many others, to see how they devote their life to the welfare of others, then I have great admiration for that state of mind. So at least my motivation for speaking here should be something at least similar to that, not opposite to it. And then from the side of the people who are who are forced to listen to me, then it would be good if your motivation were somehow similar. You know, we're here together for, well, for the remaining 45 minutes or so. And, you know, turning our mind to this mind training tradition of Atisha's. But why? Not just to collect facts about Buddhism, you know, not to become a erudite, you know, like a high-ranking professor. Not that. But so that somehow or other, our heart can open. And open as fully as it's possible. You know? And at least begin the process of an opening which eventually can culminate in the full enlightenment of Buddhahood. So right at the moment there's, I'm not sure, 20, 25 of us, something like that, in this room together, whatever number it is. Right? But outside of this room, there are countless, hundreds, thousands, millions, billion of people wandering around this planet. And like ourselves, they want nothing other than some peace of mind, some happiness, some well-being. And yet, the areas, by and large, with exceptions, of course, the areas in which they're searching for this happiness are incapable of giving anything more than the briefest experience of pleasure. And many of the actions aren't even able to give that. Instead, they just more and more deeply ingrain the habit of selfishness and all of the suffering and frustration that leads to. For myself, I find it helpful not to start on the level of 7 billion people on the planet or all sentient beings, which are the phrases that are often used when trying to cultivate this motivation, but to start on something much more modest. You know? Like in our life, there's probably at least one person, if not more, that we can think of right at this present moment. Someone who we really care for deeply, but who is in one way or another lost and miserable. You know, maybe it's a physical problem that they have that they don't know how to get rid of. But on a deeper level of misery, it's this kind of anguish, this worry, this feeling of being lost and fragmented. And among our acquaintances, there can be someone that we really care for who is suffering like that. And just think how wonderful it would be if this person that we really have great affection and great love for, could be released from all of that anguish and worry. You can try to imagine that if you have an acquaintance who's in that a situation like that. Someone perhaps who keeps doing the same thing over and over again and it just is just tying this person into tighter and tighter knots. Are there people in your experience that you know that kind of fit that description? Right?
Our governments?
No, think of someone who you know personally. No, think of someone you know personally who is making themselves miserable trying to be happy, but going about it in a way that is just making themselves and the people surrounding them more and more miserable. Right? Someone that you can relate to, not someone in some other state or other city, you know, or other realm of existence, but someone in your circle. Right? You know, you think of the people who are who can't maintain relationships of any type, whether it's a romantic relationship or any other type of relationship. There's people who, as they try to leave unsatisfactory relationships behind, carry into the new relationship, whatever type it is, the same kind of confusion and anger and suspicion and discontent, which ruined the earlier relationship, and after a while is going to, you can see it, is going to ruin the next one as well, until the person ends up just lonely and miserable. That's not unusual. There's lots and lots and lots of people who experience that. Right? So if we know somebody in our life that we already have some feeling of affection and love and compassion for, right? Someone who is experiencing this kind of syndrome, then think, how wonderful it would be if I could tame my own mind, experience my own lessening of afflictions, cultivate the positive qualities of mind to such an extent that I'd actually be able to help my friend. Because a lot of times, we have a friend, we want to help him or her, but we don't know the right thing to say or the right thing to do. We don't know when to be gentle and then fall into the extreme of just enabling their destructive behavior by being too gentle, or being rough and then fall in the extreme of actually causing anger to arise because we're too rough. And we don't know what the middle ground is, or we just don't have the skill. It's like someone who, because he or she is not a doctor, doesn't know how to fix the broken arm of somebody, and wishes, oh, I wish I had that skill, then I could help this person who just broke his arm. So it's this wish to have all the abilities that are necessary to help, not just care for somebody else's body, like, you know, bandaging their arm, putting it in a splint or whatever, but really, really treat the syndrome, the mental syndrome, which is responsible for this repeated dissatisfaction and suffering. So if we just spent a minute thinking that, if nothing else, maybe by exposing my mind and thinking about and studying and questioning these teachings on Mahayana mind training, thought transformation, maybe by doing this, I'll be in a better position to be able to provide real comfort and direction for this dear friend of mine who seems to be wandering aimlessly, repeating the same kind of disappointment over and over again. And if that thought, that wish, that compassionate, loving motivation, if we can feel that starting, something in our heart starts to open, so we're starting to feel that, then it's like a light that's shining. And then we can just shine that same light in ever-increasing arcs. So it includes not only that dear friend that we're thinking about, but all of the people that we encounter. Various friends, neighbors, business associates, people we encounter every day, but haven't yet become really friendly with, but we recognize them, up to including complete strangers, whose lives are every bit as textured as our life and the life of our dear friend, and even possibly including, as we train our mind well enough, even those people who currently we find extremely annoying, who we might even classify as our foe, our enemy, our competitor. In fact, the more we think about it, a person who we regard with great distaste, it's probably because this person, in our point of view, has done something really harmful to us or to one of our family members or friends. Maybe it's a person who continually lies and is untrustworthy. And we don't like this person because of that complete untrustworthy, harmful behavior. But think about it. Even that person, even that enemy, only harms other people when they're together. When they're separate, he has no ability to harm anyone else. Right? But when that person's alone, he has to live, he or she, has to live with that mind. That untrustworthy, dishonest, conniving, harmful mind. And so the true victim of that negativity is the person himself or herself. And so, in fact, such a person becomes a perfect recipient of our compassion, our wish for them to be separated from suffering, because they cause suffering to themselves even when they're by themselves. Whereas they only cause suffering to other people when they're in contact or communication with them somehow. So even the person that we initially might think it would be hard to develop compassion for, when we see how much harm they're doing to themselves, becomes an object of compassion. And even such a person can be the object of our bodhicitta wish. May I achieve, or at least progress along the path to enlightenment, to be able to help all of these beings, from the dearest friend to the worst enemy, to overcome the suffering and dissatisfaction that none of us wants, and to experience the peace of mind and sense of well-being and fulfillment that is the deepest wish of all beings. Okay, so that concludes the motivation. I didn't quite do a Lama Zopa for several reasons, but only went about 50 minutes. But as I said, it's the most important thing is to be able to taste, to some extent, you know, at least the beginning seeds of such a compassionate motivation is the bodhicitta. So you've been sitting patiently for many of you for even an hour at this point. So maybe if you feel the need of it, you can kind of stand and stretch. And then after I ring the bell, we can come, those of you who wish to continue, we can come back And then I can turn to the text or the teaching that was supposed to be the subject matter of this weekend. Okay? So if you need to stand or stretch, we'll have a break for just about 2 minutes. So, you know, my original intention was to start this session in a fashion similar to the way many sessions here at Kadampa Center start. And also, it's a practice in many, many centers in the West and in India and other places as well. And that is by reciting a four-line prayer which embodies all of the most important elements of the practice of the motivation. It includes taking refuge in the teachings which provide the cessation of suffering and the cultivation of that bodhicitta motivation. So I'm just going to repeat this prayer once in English. Some of you know it or have it. You can do it together with me. The way I like to do it is just to recite all four lines together, and then the last line, repeat it two more times. Okay. So this prayer, the first two lines focus on directing our mind towards the source of spiritual benefit, which in the Buddhist tradition is identified as the teacher, the Buddha, the teachings, the Dharma, and the spiritual community, the Sangha. And then the last two lines is the wish to use whatever activity we're engaged in order to enhance the bodhicitta motivation and thereby be able to bring maximum benefit to others. So this very short prayer, which is recited in so many different traditions, has the essence of what this Mahayana motivation is really all about. So while I recite the words, you can read along with me. I'll probably be reading a little bit slowly. And then, of course, the important thing is to think of the meaning of the words rather than just simply reciting the sounds. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Good. So two comments I want to make about that prayer before continuing on. One is that, of course, there's nothing wrong with changing all of that from singular to plural, right? So it's not just I go for refuge, but we go for refuge. That would be fine. There's something about that I find quite comfortable. So that's no matter what the words are that we say, we can be thinking in the plural, not just in the singular. And then there's something else, which some of you here may know. This prayer can be modified simply by changing four of the syllables in the third line. In other words, we can modify it to fit whatever the situation might be. So at the present moment, the prayer starts, first two lines of the refuge are unchanged. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. But the third line is by my practice of giving and other perfections. Okay? So what does it mean when it say perfections? Do you know what that term refers to? Anyone? Yeah, the six perfections. Is that familiar to anyone here? Six perfections? Oh, okay. So we're talking in general about the path that leads to enlightenment. So that's the path of the so-called bodhisattva, the compassionate-minded being who wants to attain that enlightenment for the sake of others. And bodhicitta is that wish, that intention. But having cultivated that intention, or at least starting to cultivate that intention, then it's necessary to practice different aspects of the spiritual path. Just wishing to become enlightened isn't going to get you enlightened. So those different activities are known as the six perfections. And the first of those six is giving or generosity. So here, this is like a shorthand. By practicing giving and other perfections, the first one's mentioned, the others are implied. Okay? So this is a very general way of saying, by all the activities that I engage in order to follow this path to enlightenment, by the virtue of all of those activities, may I actually become a Buddha to benefit other beings. Okay? But sometimes, in a situation like in a teaching situation, that third line gets modified a bit. Is anyone familiar with that modification? Donna is. Anyone else? Yeah? Okay. You can modify it to apply to the specific thing that's happening now. So, for example, instead of saying by my practice of giving in other perfections, you could say by my practice of listening to the teaching. You know, by my activity of listening to the teaching. Or I could say by my practice of giving the teaching. Right? And then the last line is the same. May we become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And there are a number of prayers in Tibetan that are like that. Once you learn the basic prayer, you find that you can change one of the lines. Often it's the fourth line. Right? You say it one way, and it's a prayer for refuge. You say it, change a few syllables in the last line, and it's a prayer of prostration. I change another few, the same syllables again to something else, and it's for making a request. So if you're like me and have trouble memorizing very much, sometimes just memorizing one four-line prayer gives you access to several, because all you have to do is change the specific syllables that are specific to the activity that you're doing. But in this case, the syllables that are changed are the first four syllables of the third line. Okay? I just wanted to point that out because some people, they learn this prayer, and then they go to attend a teaching, and then when they listen, they hear that the teacher and some of the other students aren't saying the same prayer. They're saying something else. They're mostly saying the same prayer, but the third line is different, and that's the reason. They're just substituting something to make it more specific. But this general one, dagi jinsok, giving, which just simply means giving, etc. That's all it means is in Tibetan, is giving, etc. Right? In English, by my practice of giving and other perfections. Okay? So that covers the whole range of possible bodhisattva-like activities. You know, so that's like an omnibus, covers everything. Right? But you can make it more specific in certain situations. Okay. Okay. In the little time that we have left, I just wanted to say that the teaching that I was asked to give when I was invited here is of a text known as the 7-point mind training or 7-point thought transformation. And in the Tibetan tradition, there are a number of teachings in this mind training or thought transformation literature. And just the Tibetan for that thought transformation or mind training, again, is just lo jung. Lo means mind or thought, and jung means training or transformation. So whichever translation you use, it means the same thing, lo jung. And these are the teachings for cultivating this precious bodhicitta motivation and enhancing it from the tradition of Atisha, going back to other great masters such as Shantideva and Nagarjuna, and of course originally Buddha himself. So it was this 7-point thought transformation that was asked to talk about. But it's a difficult text to talk about in detail, especially if we only have a weekend, and especially if I give really, really long introductions, so it cuts down on the amount of time that we have left. But it's not, how to say, I don't want to say it's not a coherent text, because it is coherent, but it doesn't follow in order like so many texts do. Rather, it presents a bit here and presents something else here and something else here, and the overall shape fits together, but it doesn't have that kind of progression that a composed text often has. And I think, I may be wrong about this, but I think the reason is that when Atisha came and taught, he very often taught in epigrams, just a sentence at a time, you know, and then a commentary on the meaning behind that sentence. And then his followers collected all of these statements and then put it together. And so Geshe Chikawa, who put together this particular text, studied with some of the major disciples of Atisha and received the lineage of Atisha's teaching. Chikawa, in fact, studied with his teacher for 12 years, receiving all of these lineages, and then put together all of these kind of maxims and sayings, put it together in the form that we have now. But it isn't as if he composed the text in an organic form from the beginning to the end. Right? It was like a group of aphorisms or sayings to a large extent, divided up into 7 groups. So hopefully, when I had some major computer trouble today, so I put together a bunch of information to have reproduced for you, but we can't get it off the flash drive yet. But hopefully it will magically appear tomorrow, and then you can get this material. And it will include an outline of the 7 major points of this 7-point mind training by Chikawa. And during the whatever time we have left, we'll go over what I feel is the major, most important aspects of these, because we can't, even if, as I said, even if we had much, much more time, there's no way of covering all of them. But at least we can get a general idea of what's involved in the text and home in on the ones that are probably, for our purposes, the most practical and the most useful, which happens to be the 4th of the 7 points. Okay, but we'll get to that. Hopefully we'll get to that tomorrow. Okay. So before, as I said, now we only have a few minutes left. I've done a lot of talking around the subject matter, but maybe there's something that you'd like to bring up. If it's something that I can clarify, I'd be happy to. If it's a question I can't answer, I'll just admit it. So is there anything on your mind that you'd like you'd like to ask about? Or, yes, please.
So could you say that we can know
for the people who are streaming? Thank you.
So could you say that even though it might sound selfish,
can you hold it to your mouth? Sorry, real close.
Okay. you might say that even though it sounds selfish, to devote yourself to perfecting yourself would be the greatest benefit you could do to the rest of the sentient universe.
Yes, exactly. The fact that something is oriented towards oneself doesn't mean it's selfish in the way we usually use the term selfish. Right? To give a perfect example, and this is also part of the Lojong teachings, as part of the 7-point transformation, in fact. So at least before this course ends, I'm going to at least touch the text, right? But, for example, when we eat food, is this a selfish activity or not? Well, it is definitely self-oriented because we're sticking the food into my mouth, not somebody else's mouth. It's not like a mother who's feeding a baby. So it's self-oriented activity. You know, we're feeding ourselves. Whether it's selfish or not, whether it's a selfish activity or not, totally depends on our attitude, on our motivation, on the way we're doing the eating. If we're just kind of shoving it in, right? That's one way of eating. But, for example, if we're taking the food as if it were medicine, right? Because we know that if we don't eat healthy food, we're going to be weak and frail. And we want to be stronger and healthy because that way we can engage in behavior, let's say our job or social behavior to benefit others. So even though the food is going into my body and is for me, so myself, it's still not selfish if we're eating it in order to be able to benefit others. Right? So I think that's a way of understanding your comment, that working on oneself, trying to perfect oneself, I think was the phrase you used, trying to perfect oneself, you know, achieve the various levels of the spiritual path. Well, we can only work on ourselves. We can't force another person to progress spiritually. You know, we're the object of our training. So even though it's self-oriented, it isn't by any means necessarily selfish at all, especially when the end motivation is to be able to reach a state where we can, as the phrase goes, spontaneously and effortlessly be of benefit to others. Right? Is that helpful at all? Okay. Does that bring up any other question or point or something you'd like to discuss? Okay. So, I'm going to start on what was going to be the first page of the written material I was going to give you, and hopefully we'll be able to give you tomorrow. And if I can't, then we just have to do without the written material. And it's entitled A Few Quotations and Notes on Mind Training. These are some things. They don't specifically come from the 7-point mind training, but it is a way of getting a deep feel for what's going on in the mind training procedure. And it starts with a quotation by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I came across this quite recently. There was a very, very interesting video on YouTube of a meeting that he had, a teaching that he gave in India. I think he gave it a few years ago, not too long ago. And the audience was by and large young Indian students. And this one young woman got up and said that she had been reciting the mantra of compassion, which many of you know, Om Mani Padme Hum. She had been reciting that many times, but she had never received teachings on what it meant. And so she was asking the Dalai Lama, and he gave a very short but very comprehensive explanation of the deep esoteric meaning of Om Mani Padme Hum. And he pointed out, before he gave the explanation, he pointed out that just simply reciting something without knowing its meaning is a very limited value. There might be some value, right? But very limited value. But instead, we have to engage with it and try to understand the meaning. And then, at that point, he said the following. He said, the whole Buddhist system is to utilize our human intelligence in the maximum way, and by doing so, to transform our emotions. That is the Buddhist approach. I want to read it again. The whole Buddhist system is to utilize our human intelligence in the maximum way, and by doing so, to transform our emotions. That is the Buddhist approach. And that's quite interesting. I had never heard it put that way before I saw that video on YouTube, but that the Buddhist approach is to use intelligence to transform emotions. Right? And clearly what it means is to diminish the strength and eventually completely eliminate those emotions which are destructive. Right? You know, you're not interested in diminishing or eliminating the emotion of love or compassion, but certainly the emotion of jealousy, spite, arrogance, hatred, ignorance, those are to be diminished and eventually eliminated. Right? So to use intelligence to change the emotions. And when I first came across it, I thought, you know, when I was younger, if I had read something like that, it would have somehow turned me off. You know, it's like using, I would have thought, oh, it's you use your thinking mind to control your heart. You know, it seemed a little weird. You know, like trying to, you don't like what this emotion is, so you use your head, your mind, your brain, to somehow change that. Seemed to have an element of artificiality behind it. I mean, that's what I would have thought when I was younger, before I actually started studying. Does anyone resonate with that doubt that I have?
Yeah.
You know, that it seems like some kind of clamping down artificially on something? You know, because a lot of us, we kind of pride ourselves in our emotions. Well, that's what I'm feeling. You know, yeah, I'm pissed off, so I'm angry. Yeah, that's what I'm feeling. Right? Right? Or whatever it is. And then to use intelligence to, as the Dalai Lama says, to transform our emotions seems to have an element of artificiality about it, or could be thought of that way. I think someone had a comment. Yes. Oh. Next time we'll have 25 microphones, and everyone will bring their own one in.
But that would sort of negate the saying, listen to your gut.
What would negate it?
Well, if you're talking about your mind controlling your emotions, then that would go against the belief in the truth of what your gut says is the truth.
That's what I meant to say. When I had that, well, retroactively, I had that doubt. You know, I imagined what I would have thought had I come to that, had I heard the Dalai Lama say that, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, I would have responded just like you did, you know, like, aren't we supposed to listen to our gut, you know? Isn't there something primary about that? And isn't the intelligence that would transform that something added on to it, something artificial? That's exactly why I said I had that doubt, and I wondered if anyone else shared that to any extent. Okay? Well, tell you what. Okay, I'm going to get out of this in a really sneaky way. I'm not going to tell you how I feel we get around that impasse. You know, because it's a valid concern, but we can overcome it. And the teachings do overcome it. I'm going to just let you think about that, the relationship between intelligence and emotions. And then, hopefully, those of you who come back tomorrow, then we can explore it a little bit more, especially what the Buddhist teachings have to say about it. Because, for the third and last time, the Dalai Lama points out very strictly, he says, the whole Buddhist system is to utilize our human intelligence in the maximum way. And their maximum way is a very significant phrase. And by doing so, transform our emotions. This is the Buddhist approach, right? So either there's something terribly wrong with the Buddhist approach, because it's telling us not to trust our gut at all, right? Or there's another way of understanding it. Okay? So maybe you can, you know, think about that, think about how you would approach it, and then that's where we'll start. That's where we'll start tomorrow. Okay? And hopefully we'll have solved the problem and you'll actually get handouts. Otherwise, it'll just be a matter of listening to the explanation. But I hope I'll be able to get the handouts to you. Okay? So, the first part was the motivation. The second part was the main activity. And, of course, the main activity was just an extended motivation, right? And during that time, what we try to bring to the fore is as much concentration as we can. We try to, like on the part of the teacher, try not to constantly leave the subject matter and go elsewhere, which is a failing of mine. And the part of the listener is to try to stay with it as much as possible. So there's a certain concentration and a certain level of, maybe we could call it faithful interest. In other words, paying attention to it with a mind like, maybe there's something of benefit here. Right? So a level of interest based on some level of faith that there can be some value to be found in it. So that's the attitude to cultivate in the second section, which is the main part of the teaching situation. And then at the end, there's the dedication. And I'm going to be very disciplined and just give it without extensive commentary. Because as many of you here know, being a student of Lama Zopa, one could emulate him and the dedication could take several hours. Which and that's without exaggeration, by the way. That's not an exaggerated statement. It can literally take several hours. But instead of doing that, we can think that if any of the activity that we've engaged here together, any of us collectively, or all of us collectively, or any of us individually, if any of it has any value, any merit, any benefit, may we dedicate this merit so that all beings may be released from their mental and physical sufferings. So that teachers such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Kepje Zopa Rinpoche may be endowed with long and fruitful lives. So that we ourselves come under the benevolent care of such compassionate teachers in this and all our future states of existence. So that the enlightened beings inhabiting every corner of the universe continue to turn the peerless wheel of the Dharma. And so that we ourselves complete our spiritual path as swiftly as possible in order to be able to repay the infinite kindness we've received from each and every sentient beings. And if we can make a dedication like that, and in the back of the mind recognize that all the elements of that dedication lack even one atom of concrete self-existence, but are mere dependent arisings appearing to the mind, then the dedication is sealed with wisdom. Okay. Thank you for your patience. Hope to see some of you tomorrow. And please don't wait for me to leave. You'll be waiting a while.
Just one quick announcement, a note that I didn't think of before John came into the room. We do have a full day tomorrow starting at 10 o'clock, and we'll have an hour and a half break for lunch. We encourage people to bring a lunch so that during the break we can all get together and talk about what we've heard in the morning, and that discussion helps seal our knowledge of it. So, and it's also fun because if we don't know each other, we get to know each other, and if we know each other, we spend time with our friends. So bring your lunch, and we'll see you in the morning.